They can't control you here, you know.
No. So it's Wednesday, the 10th of December 2014. It's an LPRG meeting, and we're discussing Penny Eckert's Journal of Sociolinguistics paper 2008, Variation and the Indexical Field.
Right. What do we think of it?
Interesting, mm-hmm. But it struck me as Penny Eckert. I mean, oh, you know, obviously very saying very well, but on things you think, don't we know this already? Or a lot of it we kind of know already. Or maybe that's because I'm so in qualitative head, and then quantitative people kind of need to hear that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hello.
Hi, sorry for being late. I was just in another meeting, so I'm going to set up the Skype connection operation now as well. But please continue. Something about the article making being too...
Don't we know
being
already?
Not being used.
I think that the... Well,
6 years ago, right? 6 years ago.
True, yeah. I mean,
yeah,
there is that,
yeah,
as well.
So written 7 years ago.
Yeah,
yes.
I mean, that's the other thing. It's very difficult to put your head, you know, when this was being written at sort of 2007 or something like that. So maybe that... But being Penny Eckert is also very well put together.
I think,
yeah.
Yeah.
It does something, though, that I think lots of the qualitative sociolinguistic stuff hasn't done, where it really kind of engages with part of linguistic anthropology. So here it's Silverstein or Silverstein, and I've sort of emerged myself in some of the work in linguistic anthropology, particularly the semiotic stuff recently. And there's so much in there that I feel is incredibly impenetrable, but is incredibly useful, that I think we need people doing this sort of thing. Like, I don't know if anybody went and tried to read the indexical odd paper, the 2003.
Silverstein, yeah.
It's
brilliant.
It is brilliant, but it's pages and pages and pages of quite... If you're not aware of what he's driving at, it's quite difficult to read. Or at least that was my opinion.
Is that the one where the paper where he takes apart, you know, that thing from Levinson Sites, and it's about insertion sequences. The man goes into a shop to buy some paint. And then he totally reinterprets it from the angle of indexicality.
Yeah.
And it makes totally different sense. So, yeah, it's a paradigm shift.
Yeah.
Really, isn't it? It's about saying there is a paradigm shift here. Same data, look at it from a different perspective, it means something entirely different.
Something else I should read. The many things I should read.
Sorry to interrupt you again. Is it okay if I Skype in Rachel now? Because
Rachel Mouse.
Yeah, she didn't want to be here, and I told her I was just used this Mac. So. Hi, Rachel.
Hello.
No, we all hate Rachel Max. Oh, hi, Rachel.
Hello, Andrew.
Yeah.
Okay, I know the connection is not perhaps the best. Sorry,
well,
Jack.
Well, I can see you in the fridge, so it's okay.
But I can move it around.
Yeah, you're a constantly pivoting camera angle.
It's like carrying a purse around.
So
going around the room.
Do you hear it all right?
Is that Bethan?
Yes,
that's
right.
Chris here.
Chris.
Hello.
Chris.
Hi.
Yes.
So,
Fatia.
Hi.
Zaina.
Hi.
Me again.
Doya. So, yeah, that's everyone. Can you hear us all right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
All right, so I think I will suggest you to kind of look at this when you want to include Rachel.
Or maybe I have to say, Rachel, what do you think?
We could self-select
by name.
And just kind of shout when you want to say something at times.
So the sentiment that you've missed so far, Rachel, is, didn't we know this already? And we've recontextualised it to remember that it must have been written in 2007. Then you said, what do you say, Jack?
About Silverstein.
I just said about approaching linguistic anthropology and sort of bridging, because I don't think there are necessarily gaps in terms of the drive behind sociolinguistics, or this kind of sociolinguistics and linguistic anthropology. But there are often maybe definitional gaps or differences in how people interpret things or whatever, but I think the actual motivation behind the two things is very, it's data driven, it's bottom up, and it's
how do things mean the things they mean? How do things acquire social meaning?
Well, I do think it's coming from a kind of US sociolinguistic linguistic context, which does have a much greater division between these kind of aspects. But I mean, for us, it's kind of all
variations.
Because I mean, you know, most of us would not be in a linguistics department if we were in the US.
We would
be in anthropology
or sociology, probably.
I think anthropology, sociology. We wouldn't be in linguistics, so there is a greater divide on that in the US than there is here.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, but I think that coming from anthropology, they just start off with different questions, whereas if you're coming at it from a linguistic perspective, you sort of assume that language has meaning, you know, that words have meanings and things like that. From an anthropological perspective, you go into a culture, you don't know what anything means, you don't know what the words mean, so you're using the context to work out what the words and what the gestures and everything mean. So you're starting from the bottom up, and you don't go in there with an etic concept as such. And For me, I really like that because it makes you start from the bottom and think, okay, so when you swear, what does it actually mean to the people who are there and around you and listening to you swear? It's not coming at it saying, okay, I've got this theory that can explain this. It's saying, you know, how do we know that this means what it appears to mean? So first of all, what does it appear to mean? And then how do we know that? And I think it's coming at it from that angle.
But I just like to add, and this is something that it's one of those realizations where when you have it, you realize actually you should have realized this was the question you were asking for however many years you've been asking it. But it was that in linguistic anthropology, the question is often more about how do we interpret meaning? What is our framework
process
for understanding meaning?
Yeah.
Whereas in linguistics or in sociolinguistics, that's sort of assumed, and it's usually a symbolic. We have meaning in a symbolic sense, and in anthropology, there's far more. Well, this is why this whole thing's about indexicality. There's far more room to manoeuvre about what we actually think meaning is, not just what the meaning of X is.
Yeah, absolutely.
But again, that is one particular view of sociolinguistics, because that anthropological approach does go back quite far. Goes back to Delheim's, at least, doesn't it? And even in linguistics proper, I mean, a lot of the, you know, the discovery procedures and stuff, they were people who went into exotic environments and said, how do we find out what these people are talking about?
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
So, I don't know, in American institutions, do they make the distinction between those early linguists, the structural linguists that went into, like, Indian communities to record Indian languages? Do they class that as anthropology, or do they class that as something different?
Maybe so, but I mean, if my education, maybe, you know, because I've been, because it, when I did it with you know, Peter Trudgill, they still acknowledged, even though he, you know, he's very much in that variationist paradigm, but there was still, we still talked about Delheim's and that, well, meaning comes from the context kind of thing as well.
So
I don't know whether it's a particularly American thing. I mean, they like quantitative studies a lot.
Although that's becoming much bigger here as well now. So, but yeah, I think kind of what you said, that the idea of what things meant was always there.
Wasn't always a focus, because
it was assumed that it meant something, and then you focused on these other things, you know, about how it meant. You know. But he was also thinking, you know, a new focus on how we mean things. And I thought, well, what about pragmatics? What about systemic function?
Yes, what about how are they?
But what this adds is ideology, how ideology feeds into how things mean. What it lacks is pragmatics. So it lacks a pragmatic element. So how you explain then? So it's saying that the indexical field is out there. It's sort of you get an ideology around certain words, and that's and every iteration of those words repeats and renovates that ideology. But if you started using those words in a different context, you generate a different ideology. So it's able to talk about how things mean, but also how language things change their meaning.
Yes. Really it explained something to me, which maybe, you know, somebody has studied and I just don't know about it, but something that I've noticed sort of casually in terms of language change is that people are tending to pronounce the word that is spelled M-A-S-T-E-R as in one way, rather than having a north-south differentiation in the vowel,
in the initial
vowel. So that even people from the north, I know, will say, they might say bath and path, but they'll say master.
Interesting.
Jack's got that indigenous in his dialect already, haven't you, Jack?
I think, I mean, as far as I'm a master user, but I'm also a plaster user. But I've got a feeling, and I don't know. This is pop linguistics.
You're a disaster user.
I don't know.
You have to catch up.
I've had
a
reasonably sheltered life, so I've not had to. But anyway. And I remember, I think it was Leslie Jeffries I was talking to, who said that once upon a time there was something to do with the etymology, and it's from Teesside and Tyneside, where they've retained the distinction, because in certain situations I will say plaster and master.
Right.
But usually, I can't actually think what the distinction is, but I do use master quite a lot, that's the point. I don't think it's the whole of the north, is what I'm saying. I think there are pockets where there is...
You think it's regional?
Yeah, where there is this master use.
But is it because of the context in which the word master occurs? Is that what's causing you to pronounce that particular vowel separately?
This would explain, because it's the ideology surrounding that particular word.
Yeah, yeah.
So you could explain it as that motivates more prestigious pronunciation.
Yes.
So, anybody else noticed it? Has anybody else?
No,
it seems to me that it's something that's it's a recent thing.
Mm,
and
I've
started noticing it in the last few years. It does irritate me, I have to say. I feel like saying, why are you saying master?
Yes. I don't know.
I'm saying master.
I'm just waiting back at class.
I'll now have to listen out.
And I think I have actually asked one or two people. Not in that tone of voice, but... notice that you pronounce it this way, and they said, isn't that the correct way to say it?
So we're going to have to record them and then sort of do a collocation thing to find out, where does that pronunciation occur?
But it made me wonder if anybody that studies language change, and I don't, has looked at that as a factor that, you know, people start...
Yeah.
Say pronouncing one word in a particular way because of its connotations, and then it kind of might spread out to other words as well.
Mm. Well, I don't think people like Penny Eckert, they do look at like stylization, right? So they look at different pronunciation of phonetics pronunciation in different contexts.
Yes.
So
they don't assume just because you're from the north you speak in a particular way all the time.
I think the master example is slightly different, because that would suggest that in certain situations they would put on have a certain style where, you know, you say plaster and master and laugh. Whereas this seems to be the people I've noticed using it.
Is it just one
one word that one in you know any context. That word comes up in master.
I would be tempted to find out whether or not there's a correlation between whether or not a word has a nominal and verbal form, so like master and plaster, where you can say to master and to plaster, versus a word that doesn't, like bath, where you would say bathe.
Or disaster.
And whether or not there is...
Because
when... I think I would be tempted...
That wouldn't have grass, though, would it?
But
or grass.
But say that again.
Well,
grass is a verb as well.
Grass both have verbal forms.
Well, I don't know then. I just always
there
remember.
It was a good hypothesis.
I remember being.
It was a working hypothesis.
I remember I remember first studying linguistics.
Give it so easily, Jack.
And thinking that there was a distinction in the way that I pronounce it, and that I would, and I don't know, when it's your own accent, it's just stupid because you will convince yourself that you do certain things that you don't do. But I definitely say master and plaster, and I don't do it with any other words.
I'm going to look out for that.
Yeah.
Right, report next time.
Let's try and trap him into a situation where he has to say plaster.
Just drop in. What's that wall made out of?
I did like the idea of all these elements coming together to create styles. And that we kind of draw. And I think it... And although, again, I don't think Penny kind of, as she did with community practice, kind of grappled with the complexity of how difficult... I think, you know, it kind of reinforces how difficult it is to style yourself in a particular way successfully unless you've got, you know, whatever... whatever it is that enables you to style yourself. Or you know, that some people are better somehow perhaps kind of managing that process than others. But it's just that, you know, you must, but yeah, all these levels, into, you know, what vowel variant you're using, what clothes you're wearing, what, you know, is that thing about the preppy girls with it using, yeah. What was it? It wasn't, was it Irish?
They kept their blue jeans, but they peg legged them.
They kept their blue jeans because they thought.
Because they're neither one nor the other.
Because the eye makeup was, you know, too much.
Yeah.
And it's just like, you know.
Slutty, I think, was the word.
It's just like all those sort of. All those layering of things. And then what it made me think of, so I went to see the Grayson X Perry exhibition on Friday. Grayson Perry Champagne and Tapestries. And they're all it's filled with these indexical items, actually, when you look at them. Having read that, it's a kind of. I've got pictures on my iPad if I want to have a look, but it's sort of all these kind of, iPods and. Got the Guardian and makes things are making coffee and you know all the things that make me sort of because it's about it's the Rake's Progress. This is a series of six tapestries where this boy is born into a very poor household, working class, and slowly kind of you know through education makes himself into a, he fits into a kind of Steve Jobs kind of character. But looking at how each you know, as he kind of shifts through the class system in the UK, how all that is indexed by the people he's talking to, what they're wearing, what's surrounding them, and it kind of really made me know exactly that kind of layering going on
supplies.
But it's really interesting that I think that type of distinction matters at certain points of life. More than others. So being a teenager, it's really
Well, you're starting to create yourself, aren't you? It's when you're becoming. It's the first time, really, that you are distinguishing yourself from your family as an independent adult. A pseudo adult, which I think is what you know makes the conflict of being an adult. All this to come, Andrew. Enjoy. but it's that kind of struggle between.
I think she's saying I'm immature.
Yeah, I didn't realise
it's because I have a 9-year-old and an 11-year-old boy. Yes, just for those people that don't recognise the connection.
Wasn't quite what I meant, but so there's just like.
So it's when things are.
It's very high stakes. Whereas once you've, you're kind of settled and all those things are in place, it's less, well, if you don't fit in, well.
Who cares?
You might care to some extent, but it's not critical. It's not like your whole. Being defined, it depends on.
No, and for teenagers, absolutely excruciating if they don't fit in. Mm-hmm. It's their whole identity is at stake, and their whole identity is sort of them. You know, their outward identity is them at that stage, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I'm also thinking there are points, sort of like pressure points, like class differences and so on. Just every now and again, so sort of working class people don't care what they wear, middle class people don't care what they wear, but at the edges. Where you want to make the distinction, then people sort of pick up on really minute details. So it's just at certain pressure points.
Yeah, people that are
that what index matters.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose you could relate that to Trugill's series about gender lower
middle class.
Class.
It's the whole
hypercorrection. It's the one below the top.
Yes.
I think the idea of pressure points, you would have to elaborate, because it's not just about, there aren't just demographic pressure points in that sense, but there are also situational pressure points.
Yeah. Right. So you change job.
Yeah, for example, let's say...
Get a new girlfriend.
You have lots and lots of features that index a middle-class attitude, and then you go into a working-class pub or a working men's pub, and then suddenly it's not so much... the pressure point of the fact that you might be on the fringe between two groups, but actually because you are in a situation where one group isn't expected to be there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like being being English and going to certain pubs in Leeds.
Yeah.
Not a good idea.
I see. You go there if you want a bit of the action.
Yeah, well, yeah.
To pretty figure out next talk.
Yeah, indeed.
No, I like this concept of the indexical field. I thought that was quite amazing.
Mm. Yeah, but it made me think of things like, you know, Burberry, which is kind of something that's, I mean, probably now not used by the upper classes in the same way that it was, because it's become appropriated and has now all these different meanings associated with it.
Mm. This building exactly on that point, and this is why I'm not sure. So and it might be that I've misunderstood, but the indexical field seems to suggest that the first order, you have whatever quality it is that people might attribute to being a certain type of person.
It's an attribute that is a part of that person. So, for example, if you are working class, then you're going to have a regional accent, and therefore regional accents, because that's your life situation. So, therefore, regional accents, once they are associated with working class, they're open then to be used symbolically.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when it becomes a second order index.
Once you evaluate it.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that is complete in the sense that, so there's a, I don't know if it's an alternative, but there's another theory of identity where it's three-staged, rather, because the indexical order seems to be that once it just sort of builds on that second symbolic level.
Yeah.
But where you have sort of attributes and then you have sort of a realisation of attributes, but then you have what's called a reflexive realisation, where and it's things like, and I was thinking just about Burberry, where the upper class or the middle class or whatever might try and reclaim Burberry, or people reclaiming certain
march
reclaiming certain labels and things like that, where obviously there has been some shift where the symbolisation of an attribute has created a situation where these people think, okay, we can apply this to them. But then that has been reinvigorated to sort of be something that you're proud of again.
Mm. And I would have thought that Burberry, as a company, are probably working really hard right now.
Well, it's a bit like the green wax jackets.
Yes.
Barbers.
Yeah, there's been another Berber but bee thing. Yeah. Because they've kind of probably gone, because they, you know, everybody wore barbers or fake barbers in the late
1980s. Oh,
but as a marketing thing, it's sort of in their interest to make it something elite, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So that's kind of gone away now, so it's kind of gone back to its original meaning.
Yeah.
So that those extra indexical levels may be temporary.
Mm. Yes.
But this is specifically in the paper where with the peg jeans, where it indexes this previous thing that these girls have no knowledge of.
Yes.
Go.
Mm.
Although I think she's kind of quite that doesn't, that's irrelevant, because they didn't, it was kind of,
but
the
then
it's
meaningless. Yeah.
Although it might mean to other people possibly.
Mm. And then you wonder what's the motivation behind the peg jeans, and is it actually not marketing at some level? There's some guy that sits in an office who said,
"Oh, we haven't had this for a while."
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's get people to change their wardrobe and buy more stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And my comment was just about the nature of the system. And once you take anything from a system and you reassign its value, it leaves a hole behind, which now needs to be filled with other things. You know, it's like, you know, once we took gay out of happy-go-lucky and loveliness and gaiety kind of gay to mean homosexual, then we've got a hole there for the way that we describe our frivolity and joyfulness.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? So it's
constantly shifting.
It's absolutely system.
So the people who used to wear Burberry now probably wear some other specific brand.
Because they don't have that resource available to them, so they've got to go somewhere else to find the stuff to do the ideological meanings that they still, presumably, if they're the same sort of people, still want to display.
Mm. Yeah, which is bad news for Burberry.
A brilliant thing that actually mirrors that with Burberry is, and I don't know a lot about Burberry, but the thing that when Burberry got appropriated by a certain group of people, it was always,
do you know a word
we're talking about?
Yeah,
Burberry.
Yeah.
Find some Burberry. Can you find a dog? A dog wearing Burberry.
Okay.
But it was always the caps with the pattern on.
Well, wait until you see it, then you'll understand.
Oh God, how do you spell Burberry?
I think it's ugly, actually.
Here are a whole host of dogs wearing Burberry, but...
It's a particular pattern of clothing.
It's
not normally for dogs. It's normally for people.
But it's made by a company.
Yeah.
The company who make Burberry, they've always marketed themselves as being very, very high class because their material is high quality, the finish is high quality. But then,
and they're expensive items.
Extremely expensive. Yeah. But then that pattern started to be used by working class people. And
Material.
Yes, using cheaper material, but the pattern was used, that particular type of tartan or a check pattern.
I think
it just acquired a different meaning for a short while.
Yeah, I have seen it.
Yeah.
And it's very expensive.
Yes.
But I don't know what the name is.
Drunken chav, no doubt.
Aren't all chavs drunk all the time?
Yes, my darling. Yes, no, they are. And they're not drunk on Bombay gin either. They're not proper drunk. They're not correctly drunk.
I remember Burberry had a campaign, probably in 2005-2006, with lots of kind of trendy models, where the whole thing was... All the clothes are very plain, but maybe part of the lining of a jacket would have the Burberry look, like, pattern on it, or the inside of a hat. And it was this whole thing of keeping the pattern that they have, but not having it on display.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And I just thought that was an interesting move.
Mm-hmm. So it couldn't be used as a display item in the way that certain sectors of the population were using it, which was used very overtly as display.
Yeah. So the quality... is supposed to be what sells it, but I don't know what you're looking at.
Well, here's a bunch of very top-looking models, but you can't see the Burberry other than presumably
a little bit of scarf.
Yeah. Yeah. Scarf or a little bit of lining. I mean, everything else is just fairly plain.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And maybe that, because I think one of the things that I think about, I suppose stereotypes of working class is the idea of of wealth being indexed very overtly, so big jewellery and clothing be worn very ostentatiously, whereas that is very, very unostentatious. So yeah, it's an interesting marketing strategy. But it also made me think about talking to a colleague about the Grayson Perry thing, but about the index fulfillment, but how difficult it is to negotiate. So the thing we were talking about that tension point between people who are just making moving from upper working class into lower middle class, so kind of around that thing, and what to dispute as being lower middle and not working class, and that the number of things they do actually put themselves immediately into working class. So, for example, scrubbing your front step. Mm. Because the other thing is not something people would do now, but...
My mother used to.
Yeah, my mother used to.
But she was also a proprietor of a business. So, she came from... not as kind of working class, a farmer, but anyway.
Yeah.
We got this, working mentality, but she would scrub the front step.
Yeah, so did my mum, and I can remember her doing that when I was, sort of 9, 10 kind of age. I'd give it up after that. Whereas my nan used to scrub the pavement in front of the house as well as the front step. But then, it was just that kind of... And then the other was that only middle-class people have really untidy houses. If you're working class and you're just making that move, you've got to have this absolutely spotless house.
Yes.
And no books and stuff on display. Whereas if you're middle-class, you can go, I'm comfortable in my identity, thank you.
It's not just you, then.
No, that made me feel much better. so it'll be interesting. Understanding those things is not straightforward.
How does it work the other way, or kind of the other way around then, moving from thinking of street culture, middle class kids adopting hip hop lingo and
but isn't that very often the crossing, like what?
Yes. Yeah. Well, there's a particular bit where she talks about that, doesn't she? And she says, you know, they don't want to be taken for that.
No.
Or not, they're not safe.
They're
saying
indexing.
Yeah.
Coolness
but,
through it.
But I wonder how much actually they wanted to do passing.
Mm.
You know, that they would see that as the ultimate goal to be able to pass.
But does the original, place where it came from, like in the ghettos of Chicago or something, do they start to do different things to differentiate themselves? Does it happen that way around as well?
But maybe it has to be sufficiently local for you, because they probably would, how would they kind of,
So they
I know that, okay,
that's a first order indexing, what they're doing
in
Chicago or whatever, and then it's open for symbolic
appropriation
elsewhere. But it only then feeds back into the original people if they're even aware of it. So,
this,
I don't know.
Or multicultural in English.
I suppose it would also depend, though, if
or if they're doing it well enough, or if it's considered a threat in some way to their identity.
Well, at what point
becomes that?
It would depend on the what's the word? Not application, but the how widespread the feature is. So let's say that there's this relatively small niche feature in this group that then gets appropriated by a much larger group, then presumably that would feed back to the smaller group who might not want to be associated with
because it was a counterculture in the first place.
Exactly.
Now
it's
counterculture.
So they have to move on
and create
something else.
And I think that happens in youth culture a lot,
where
things like you'll get like the punk movement, and then punk becomes trendy. So then the punks are no longer punks because exactly what they were against.
I'm thinking of the stage where at one point teenage boys used to wear their underpants sort of quite low on their hips, and then their jeans even lower. Do you remember that point?
Oh,
yeah.
God.
This is just still a certain amount of it round,
yeah,
but not as much.
Yeah, still there. And again, that meant something at that moment, and then it became more common culture, and then it just disappeared with the younger people, so it lost its indexing ability.
Can I chip in?
Hello.
Yeah.
I don't know which way to look now.
Can you see now?
About where these kind of influences kind of come from, and one thing that strikes me is quite interesting because it's different from the sort of groupings that you're talking about at the moment is with deaf people in the UK, and the same would apply in other countries probably too, is that there's a lot of linguistic variation according to where you went to school.
Mm-hmm.
Because historically most deaf people, sign language users I'm talking about specifically, were educated in residential schools that were dotted around the country. For example, in Bristol and Exeter, and a couple in London and Doncaster, and in Scotland, there were two in Glasgow, one in Edinburgh, one in Dundee, one in Aberdeen, all sorts of other places around the UK. Most of these are now closed, so the landscape is very much changing now. But because these were very discrete communities around the UK, with, at the time, not that much kind of interaction between them. You know, this is from, the late 19th century onwards, really. Each of these little pockets developed dialects or whatever of their own. And so, even now, if you meet deaf adults, they will kind of, the first question is, where did you go to school? Or they might not even need to ask the question because they can identify where somebody went to school by the signs that they use. There are really extreme cases, like in Glasgow, the two schools. There was a Protestant school and a Roman Catholic school. And the Roman Catholic school was staffed initially, when it was set up, by nuns that were brought over from Ireland. So they brought with them Irish Sign Language, which is a completely different sign language, educated these kids in Glasgow. And the result is I can meet Glaswegian deaf people. I have not a Scooby's what they're talking about at all, because it is almost a different language.
Yeah.
They can understand me fine, you know, but I, you know, really had to struggle big time with them. Whereas the Protestant school had a very different teaching staff and so on. So within Glasgow, you have these very, very different sort of dialectal things going on.
Mm.
What will be interesting as all of these schools, including the two in Glasgow, have closed, is to see what kind of remnants kind of sort of persist, really, and how that kind of, plays out over time.
Mm. Because what you're saying then is that each of these different schools had their own, had a sort of a first order index in the sense that they were associated with a particular way of speaking. But as they came together, you could then recognise where that person came from because of their style of speaking.
Yeah.
Was that style of speaking then open for re-evaluation symbolically then? Because could you sort of use, for example, the Glasgow Protestant thing if you came from Liverpool in order to generate some sort of meaning? You see what I'm saying? So you can use like a working class accent to generate a meaning. Could you do something like that with deaf signing?
Potentially you could. I don't think people do.
Okay.
Because I think, from my understanding, Andrew knows Gary Quinn. Gary's written a paper about this process of schoolization and what happens with those signs, because some people are educated outside of their home area. You know, they actually travel quite a way to go to school.
Mm.
They come back, then they meet deaf people who didn't go to the same school. They might have gone to a more local school. And then what happens is a kind of meeting, sort of the person with the sort of alien sign language has to adapt more to the local language use. But people, I think, hold on to school signs as something that they're quite proud of.
Does it give them identity? I think Andrew wants to say something.
Before she ever actually wrote it down, in my head I was going, spot the page, that's of identity, spot the page, that's of identity. And then eventually, about 7 or 8 pages later, she mentioned it. And the idea about Bob LePage's stuff is we do have the ability to change our behaviours according to the people who, from time to time, we want to associate with or dissociate with.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe it's these people with the various school signs don't want enough, aren't motivated, because he's got a bunch of riders. Are you physically able to do it? Can you isolate the groups? Can you work out how to do it? Are you able to change?
Mm-hmm.
But also, are you motivated enough to change? And maybe these people in these Catholic, Protestant, whatever it is, schools,
there's
aren't motivated enough
it.
To want to associate and be like somebody else.
Mm. Yeah.
Maybe the nature of the deaf community is so... I want to say insular, I don't think that's quite the right word, but, you know... locally connected, tightly connected, that they sustain themselves in local groups and don't want to go beyond their locality. I don't know. But anyway, the Bob LePage stuff is it's we can and do change according to who from time to time, and we can opt in and opt out and change.
Yeah. Interesting. Thank you.
Another thing that really struck me, again, relating this to British Sign Language, is the talk about gay speech that Penny Eckett goes on to. And there is, in BSL, something that's known as GSV, or gay sign variation. And it is basically phonological shifts in the way that signs are articulated that deaf gay men may or may not use. They may use it, and some of them choose to use it all the time with whoever they're interacting with. Other men will use it only when they're interacting with each other and not with other people. But so one phonological shift is the change of this handshake.
Okay,
so pointing finger, this one becomes this. So using your little finger rather than that.
Okay.
So, for example, this is the sign for hearing. So a hearing person is the opposite of a deaf person. Jack can demonstrate.
Yeah, I'm doing it.
So this is the sign for hearing. So a person who is not deaf is a hearing person. But in GSV, it will be done like this. using the little finger instead of the index finger. So yeah, that's
interesting.
And that's just one example, but there's a multitude of signs where we would normally use this handshape where they will use that handshape.
That's really interesting. Because it sort of maps onto indexicalities to do with campus
well,
as well, doesn't
and
it?
What I find interesting there is that, you know, the work that's been done about it, you know, people will talk about, some people choose to use it as a blanket, this is how I do the language, and others choose to use it more selectively.
According to their audience, interesting. That's really interesting.
Which is what Heath was doing. The I built up a picture of this black gay diva GP.
Mm-hmm.
He was, you know, it depends where. So there's a nice quote which says something like, you know, it's not just variable use is not just a product of who used it, but where and when and how.
Yes.
Yeah, there's much more subtlety.
And that's going back to our original starting point of the variationist thing.
Mm.
Variables were just a thing,
yeah,
and it happens or it doesn't, or it happens this amount or it doesn't.
Yeah.
There was no uncovering the subtleties, the nuances of
that's
the
true.
Who, where, when, and what for.
And no, that is partly, you know, if that's partly the quantitative versus qualitative thing, isn't it? Because if you're going to do quantitative, you just can't do all of this stuff with the numbers required to.
No, but you need that big survey stuff in order to be able to, to dig in to find out sort of how it functions. But if you didn't have that survey stuff, you wouldn't have a starting point for the qualitative analysis.
Yeah, we wouldn't have it.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have anybody to argue against, would we?
That's true. No, but they pick up on the first order indexes, and then after that, you can sort of start to pick up on how the second order indexes or the nth order index, whatever, is being used.
And I wondered whether there's a one and a half order. One of the things that I
you'd be reading to it Harry Potter again.
I refer you to my paper where we suggest that we should have -1.5. What the variationist type people did was, here's a little bit of phonetic noise.
Mm.
And what Penny's doing in this is, it's not the phonetic noises, but it's the type of, the class of phonetic noises, the hypo or hyper articulation, the fortition or the lenition. It's so what we've got, the variables, is not the noise, but a class of behaviours.
Yes.
And I don't think I've seen that talked about before.
Yeah, that was nice, actually. And when she did that kind of visual representation of the kind of positioning of people in relation to these different
India,
I thought that was really quite nice.
Yes.
And of course, that can never be exact. You know, you normally say, well, it's 3 millimetres to that. But it was a nice way of kind of even like mapping that space.
Mm.
I thought that was quite, I quite like that.
There was the thing in the news recently. It was about Michael Balotelli being racist. Mm-hmm. Do you know about it?
He's a football manager. Football.
He's a black football player.
Oh right.
And
I didn't know that one.
Okay. And he, I think he likes computer games. And he was talking about Super Mario, and he described him as jumping like a black man and collecting money like a Jew. And he was being ironic because he's faced a lot of racism, and so he was sort of doing this stuff. And so he tweeted that, and he's been sort of being seen called in front of the FA because of being racist. And I'm just thinking about, I think indexicality has got something to say about this, and I'm trying to work out what it is.
But also, wasn't it interesting that what I heard from the radio, it was not because of the first comments about
jumping like a black man.
Jumping like, it was about the Jewish thing.
Yes.
Because
he's
black, so.
But I think his mother is Jewish.
Yeah, that's what he said, like on the radio it was all like, oh, he was stand me up because he made a comment about Jewishness, not...
But people can see that he's black, they can't tell that his mother's Jewish. He's not wearing his Jewishness on his sleeve for people to realise his legitimacy of reappropriating those terms.
Yeah. So it is about wanting to index something, wanting to use that in order to generate, to index something. But not succeeding, I suppose, is the issue.
But actually, it has to do with legitimacy, of course, and who decides what is legitimate, and that's actually quite interesting in terms of indexicality as well.
Yes, so it's almost being policed. You can index in this way, but you can't index in some other way. Yeah, so it's sort of going around in my head, and I can't work out what the connection is right now.
Suppose
sorry, I was...
Is that the close...
I think this is the closest thing we're going
to
get.
You might have to put the computer over by you.
Yeah. Sorry.
You're running out of gas, Rachel.
Trying to help you in.
I think there's something wrong.
You're fading. Okay, you're back.
Yes.
Yeah, you're running on. You're making gas now.
I mean, it could also be that the ability of someone to jump might not be assessed negatively. But greed is...
Yeah.
I think lots of it is most people don't know Balotelli's story, which is quite an interesting one, him being a black Italian footballer who faced lots of racism in his
absolutely
early career.
Yeah.
And those who do know would take it as a joke, but whenever anything gets pushed into a domain where it wasn't initially intended for, which is what happens all the time because everything is public.
Yeah.
Often some sanctioning body has to come in and have them apologise to everyone.
Yeah.
It's stupid.
I guess something is that there's an indexical field there.
Yeah.
And whatever he's saying isn't within the mainstream indexical field. It can't be accommodated by it. I think that's to me is what the issue is, but I'm not entirely sure I thought it through.
There's a lovely quote, well, for me it's a lovely quote, page 457, which says, "A stylistic agent may be more attuned to particular kinds of differences as a function of past stylistic experience." So when he's doing this, he knows his history, he knows what he's been through, he knows what saying these sorts of things mean for him.
Yeah.
But if people don't share that history...
Yeah, yeah.
He's not going to make those meanings.
No. No.
Sorry, Karen.
I was just going to ask Chris to explain a bit more about
the tweet.
Why you think it's about indexicality, because I don't get it.
I guess he's being ironic.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering what the level of knowledge and what the level of communication you have to go through in order to be able to index something. And how you account for irony and things like that within that particular model. Because
so
he's saying something racist. So saying something racist within a particular indexical field is a bad thing. And that's
so
how it
is kind of accessing those attitudes, isn't it? But using them
manipulating
to say something else.
Yeah.
So, okay, that's just something I need to think through. It's because the indexical field, if you're saying then that what something means is because of the indexical field that is available, you know, through reiterations of the use of a particular term or the use of a particular phrase or something like that.
Yeah, so if I give the whole context for that, so he tweeted an Instagram picture of the Nintendo character Mario with caption, "Don't be racist." Oops, sorry, I just clicked on something I didn't mean to. "Don't be racist, be like Mario, he's an Italian plumber created by Japanese people who speaks English and looks like a Mexican. He jumps like a black man and grabs coins like a Jew."
So there even was a context.
No,
but all that's picked up on, and the only thing that's been reported is that he jumps like a black man.
So he's calling out he's anti-Semitic.
Not the don't be racist. that crucial framing right at the beginning.
I didn't even hear that.
I didn't even know that was there.
Yeah, so I've actually ended up with a Daily Telegraph. It said, and it says, short of the context of the image, Ben just grabs coins like a Jew, it does seem shocking. But it's taken out of context.
Yeah.
You said you've got these characters, a complete melting pot.
But it's also taking a mick out of it a little bit, isn't it? I mean, making fun of it a little bit.
Absolutely.
I think that's what you're kind of trying to get at.
How does the indexical field work? How do we work that through?
Yeah. And maybe that's why it's so difficult and it's so problem causing, because it makes so many assumptions about the addressee and how they're going to react to it.
Yeah.
And I don't know an awful lot about it, but his sense of humour seems to be one where he plays on what he is aware of. Will be indexed. So, for example, there's a really famous... Well, I've read... There was a famous story about him driving around in a really posh sports car, like a Ferrari or whatever, but in boxing gloves. And it's almost like he's taking that thing that you'd expect him to do and then playing with it. Yeah. And he also, once he was driving around...
He's a football version of Andrew.
And if you
well, what I was going to say is, if he is so famous in of himself, he probably expects, like Andrew probably does, that people know what he's like,
yeah,
and therefore will know what the frame is,
yeah,
what the history or the,
yeah,
the interpretations are to expect. So there's another point somewhere around about 466 where she essentially says, our expectations will drive what we're likely to hear.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you expect him, if you know of him,
mm-hmm,
as this character,
mm-hmm,
then you will go, oh, it's just him being him.
Mm-hmm.
Just like Sarah, on many occasions, says, oh, it's just Andrew being Andrew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But isn't that the thing, because he's such a public figure, that there has to be some kind of moral order than that? His body's involved.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I don't know. That plays a big role in there as well. I don't know if you know what I mean. Not really expressing myself clearly.
I think you're right in the sense that things like the guy who, Ched Atkins, is that his name? Evans, who got done for rape, and he was offered a place back.
Sheffield.
So the idea then is that he seemed to be a public figure, and therefore to allow the public figure to be somebody who has been convicted of rape and is a role model. So yeah, I think you're right that, you know, there is this expectation that public figures like footballers do have a role because they're role models for younger people, that they do have a level of accountability. And
exactly. Although Well, it's not exactly the same thing, obviously, but with that example, I didn't think about it earlier as well, actually. But what's his name?
Balotelli.
With Balotelli, with what he said, it's also the fact that, I don't know what I want to say, actually. it's something, because it's not just that he is accountable because he is a public figure, but it's also that people maybe don't want to interpret. They know
okay,
his frame, but they don't want to interpret it.
Yes.
Yes,
they want to see the bad side. Mm.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I guess so. I have to think about
the last part. Part of what the media was, isn't it? Anyway,
yes.
Is they'll take words and, I mean, I think.
Yeah. They'll say, oh, look, Balotelli said something clever.
Yeah,
on Instagram.
So it's part of that. And it's partly that, I think, in general, in terms of being politically correct, there's an assumption, I think, a lot of people that the meaning of language is in the language, whereas we know that it's not, it's in the context.
Mm.
But most people assume that, you know,
yeah, he has said those words.
My kids
would
complain that their friends won't even use the word black in front of them because they have, I suppose, because of the indexical field of, you know, that goes with that word, whereas they're going, well, it's ridiculous.
Mm.
You know, if I am black, so why don't you describe me as black? You know, it's kind of. But it's that, the kind of the, I call it almost like the magicness of words that are, you know, that we tend to review. And I think that's part of what it is.
Mm.
It's like because you have used those words Jew and money grabbing together.
Mm.
That must be what it means, kind of thing. It must be.
Even if you say Jews are not money grabbing,
you've
got those two words.
You even mentioned it. Yeah, the fact that you've even said it.
Yeah.
But isn't it part of part of the job of the media is to find the meaning that the novel polarise people.
Exactly.
Then.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah,
it's not newsworthy otherwise.
Because it's also quite funny that he's an Italian called Mario.
Oh, that is his name?
Yeah, he's Mario Balotelli.
Yeah.
So he is a black Italian who presumably
likes to grab lots of money because he gets several hundred thousand pounds
a
week.
He's a very rich Italian Jew who's black and can probably jump like a black man, because that's what he is, literally.
So the only thing he isn't, he's Mexican.
Yeah.
He's not a plumber either.
No.
Probably.
Doesn't earn as much as a plumber.
Okay. This is how the FA described it. They said, It believes that he as an individual has brought the game into disrepute by making comments which included a reference to ethnic origin and or colour and or race. It's just
a reference
to it.
That's it.
You
can't
even
refer
to the word
to it.
In that.
So you can't even take Arsenal's black striker then,
no.
In which case can you?
No.
It's true.
Or even my mother was
like
was Jewish.
Yes.
Yeah, you have to pretend it doesn't exist.
It's amazing. Well, we need to give them lessons in linguistics, don't we? We need to go to the FA and sort them out.
Yeah.
Meaning doesn't exist.
Because part of what he's doing as well, I mean, sometimes this is what people do when they use taboo language. It's a kind of, trying to be inclusive. And if he's referring to himself and he knows that other people out there know what he's like, he's sort of, it could be seen as a way of,
so it's also
of bringing the people in and accessing their insider knowledge, so that it brings them closer.
Yeah,
and also and making fun of himself at the same time. And I think in informal speech, I think a lot of us do that all the time.
Absolutely,
it's just
that
when the papers get hold of it.
Yeah.
It's gone 5 past. What's it? We've got business to do. So this is probably a. Time to stop.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah